We're very fortunate to have Elizabeth with us here tonight. Please help me welcome Elizabeth.
Elizabeth McLean, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
so I want to thank you guys for asking me to speak. It's funny how AA kind of changes and you change with it. So as of last night, I'm not a member of Downtown Young and Sober anymore, but that's okay. That's a great home group. My sobriety date is May 29th, 2017. I have a sponsor. I sponsor other women, and I have a service position in the district. As of January, I'll be the secretary. So I'm excited about that. So I'm gonna do the normal, what it was like, what happened, and what life is like today. I grew up in Ocean View. I love Ocean View, everything about it. You know, there's places that are really, really seedy and dirty and smells like the beach, and then you have million-dollar houses right next door. So just the juxtaposition of life is definitely exciting and thrilling to me. My father was in the Navy for 25 years. He retired as a Command Master Chief. And my mother was a teacher in Norfolk for 44 years. So I say that to say that they both love to tell me what to do. And they still do to this day. And a lot of that will come out in my story. I'm the oldest of three. I'm the only girl. And I'm the only active alcoholic at one point in my family. My father, he drank regularly. He would come home with a 12-pack every day. But 15 years ago, his doctor said, your heart is being affected by your drinking. And he stopped that day, and he hasn't gone back to drinking. That wasn't my experience. So we grew up with alcohol in the house. It was one of those, oh, you have an earache, put a little whiskey in your teeth. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. And my mom says, yeah, but it makes a baby sleep. So that was probably my first drink, but my real first drink was in high school. I was in an acting company, and we went to New York City, and we snuck out of the hotel. I was a junior in high school, and we went to a fraternity party in Harlem, and I was drinking slow gin and grape soda, and I thought I was so classy. I did not drink alcoholically the first night, but I love the effect produced by alcohol. My shoulders went down, my head got quiet, I was funnier, I was smarter, I was prettier. You know, immediately I could not wait to do that again. So I didn't have any consequences that night, but I could not wait to get my hands on alcohol again. So I went to George Mason in Northern Virginia. My first year, I was so afraid that I was failing out like a good alcoholic. I made Dean's List. My second year, I joined a sorority, and I quickly found out that Elizabeth loves to party. She does not like to go to class. So I became the rush chair and the philanthropy chair and the social director, and that was just all more reasons for me to get around other people and drink the way that I wanted to drink. I went from Dean's List to failing out of college, but I didn't realize that there was a connection between that and my alcoholism. I would have just told you that I had medical problems, which I did. I started developing migraines and a couple other things. From a young age, I always felt different or not good enough or something was wrong with me. When I was 5 years old, I was sexually assaulted by a close family friend. And what he told me at the time was if I told anyone, he would kill my parents and my little brothers. 5 years old, this is a person who I loved and trusted, so I believed him. But I learned to keep secrets from a very young age. I didn't tell anyone. But I always felt that there was something deeply broken within me, and alcohol became the thing that was my solution to that brokenness. It quieted down all of the pain, and it made me able to function. In high school, I didn't drink except that one time. I was very comfortable in the world of academics. I'm very introverted by nature. It takes a lot of energy for me to be around people, but I like to be around people because it kind of pulls me out of me. I get more interested in you. I don't have to deal with what's wrong with me. Jumping forward to college. So I failed out, came home for 3 years, kind of lived on my parents' couch. but still managed. It didn't matter how bad I felt. If it was happy hour, I was able to get up and shower and go to happy hour. I couldn't hold a job down, but I could definitely make it to happy hour. Within the 3 years, I worked for an airline, and I had all these wonderful, amazing travel benefits. I never used them because I couldn't be away from the comfort of knowing that I needed a drink. I eventually went back to school. Locally, I went to Virginia Wesleyan, and then I went to grad school in Buffalo. And after that, it was time to get a job. And I'm like, can I get a PhD? And my parents were like, you are off our checkbook here, you know? But in college and grad school, I was able to still do the things that I needed to get done. Like I graduated with a 4.0 from grad school. But in Buffalo, it's either bars, sports, or churches. So I like that town. It was a fun town. Mm-hmm. I came back here. I kind of waffled around for a while, but I always managed to find my people. They were usually at Greenies, which was a little dive bar in Ocean View that was on the beach, and it was disgustingly dirty. It's like cigarette ashes everywhere, and I could not be more at home there. I would take my girlfriends with me to that bar, and they would refuse to go back. But the people that were at the bar drank like I drank, so it made me feel at home. Eventually, I kind of jumped from job to job. And then I started working for the school system. And the thing about being a teacher is you have to be sober. You know, so that those things kind of collided pretty early on for me. I was teaching and I was doing okay in the beginning. And I always promised myself that I would never drink while I was at school, right? Now I would drink till 3 or 4 in the morning and go to sleep for an hour and then get up and go to work. So that was a different day. I wasn't drinking the same day I was teaching, in my mind. And then I did do a lot of pharmaceuticals while I was teaching because the doctor gave them to me, so it was okay. Now, in Elizabeth's mind, when it says take one pill every 6 hours, I translate it into take 6 pills every 2 hours. So I quickly developed an issue of being dependent on medication. I realized that as my family and my friends kept saying, something is wrong. Like, you're really, really good at certain things, but you're terrible at other things. Your relationships are horrible. You might have a problem. My biggest enabler was my mother, and she would say, oh, it's just because she has migraines. She's taking migraine medication. That's why she's passed out on the floor. So I never thought I had a problem. I just thought I liked to party and I liked to be social. Until one day I was sitting in the laboratory trying to write a paper about the movie Braveheart for a class I was taking, and the words started swirling around the screen and I couldn't remember basic rules of punctuation. So I went outside and I called my neurologist on his cell phone and told him what was going on. And he said, whatever you do, don't go to the ER. I will get you in with a specialist tomorrow. And I said, got it. Got off the phone, went immediately to the ER. So I'm walking around with this doctor. She's being really friendly and we're talking about things and she's asking me questions, and it was the first time I had ever been honest about my drinking with anyone. She proceeded to put me on a psychiatric hold and transfer me to Maryview Hospital, meaning I could not leave the hospital of my own accord. Only a judge or a doctor could release me. So that first night in the Maryview Psych Center in the lockdown unit, I start detoxing. My hair hurt, my teeth hurt, my ears hurt. I was so sick, and I was like, what is happening? What is wrong with me? I've never felt like this. Well, I've never gone without a drink or a drug up until that day. And I was in the hospital for 6 days, and I was introduced to AA. So I went downstairs at Maryview. They had a meeting that was like 70 or 80 people. I could not tell you anything that was said at that meeting. All I can tell you was that the people in the room looked happy. They look content. They look like their lives were not that different from mine. They all had jobs, but they were okay. And I immediately did not want to have anything to do with that. I was not an alcoholic. I did not have a problem. I was not a quitter. I just needed a different psychiatric medication, is what I told people. So I left the hospital and I picked up and used again in 3 days. So then I decided I was going to start in the other fellowship. I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a pill problem. And I floundered around there for about 2 years. I had 90 days sober. He had 30 days sober, and it was a match made in heaven. I didn't have a job at the time. I didn't have a car. He didn't have a job. We moved in together. Quickly, that didn't go well. It was so bad that he asked my father for my hand in marriage, and my dad used a very explicit word and said, blank, no. And the ring that you're holding, she probably bought because you don't have any money. And which was true, I had bought the ring. I should have known then that my parents were a little concerned about my safety, but I was so in love with the chaos of being in a relationship with a using addict. That didn't go very long, and then I decided, okay, I need to just change everything up. So I'm going to go back to teaching. I was teaching in Norfolk, and then I had tried psychiatric medication. I tried a shaman. I let this woman baptize me in her pool. I tried self-help books. I tried Dr. Phil. I even wrote to Dr. Phil one time at 3 a.m, wasted out of my mind. Like, I need help, you know? And it must have been, like, convincing because the producer reached out to me. And my mother and father were like, you are not going on TV talking about your insanity. So I had just forgotten that until this time. So I was scrambling for something to fix me. So that relationship ended. I was in Burlington Coat Factory screaming at a saleswoman who had talked to my fiance. Little did I know they were having a relationship behind my back. But I was driving. I would be so intoxicated during the day that I had this habit of being at lights in stoplights, and my foot would come off the brake and I would roll into a car. I probably did that 20 times, and only one person ever had me, you know, give them my information to get their car fixed. So I was a menace to society. Still, I didn't have enough consequences to really change my behavior, but I was becoming more and more aware that something was definitely wrong with me. So I was in that relationship, and at the end of it, I went to rehab to fix it, to save the relationship. So I went to a 28-day rehab outside of Richmond. And again, they were bringing AA meetings in, and I was like, the people are so happy and so content, and they seem genuine, but I didn't think I was going through this phase. We're looking at it now, like, I really felt like I deserved to be punished for my actions, and I didn't want anything good or healthy. I wanted someone to tell me that I was a horrible person and the things I was doing were horrible to the world. So I didn't want something positive in my life. I just wanted something to fix me, the right man, the right pill, the right religion, the right job, the right weight. Once all of that came together, then I would be okay. So at rehab, I was a rock star. You know, I'm like, oh, those 12 steps, I can do that in 2 days, no problem. And the head of the rehab, he was an AA member, and he was like, you just need to slow your roll, right? And just start to learn the truth about who you are and trust the process. So I came home from rehab the 28th day, and I went out and drank that night. after all that money and time and being a superstar, the desire for me to have something quiet down my mind was way stronger than even that. So that went on for a while, and then I finally got to the point where I was increasing my usage. I was putting myself at physical risk pretty frequently. I would put myself in dangerous situations. I would wake up in places and not know where I was, not know where my car was, not know who you are. And life just kept getting dramatically more difficult. So I changed schools, and at this particular school, I remember one day my students went to lunch and they came back, and I taught high school, and there was a Gatorade bottle being passed around them. And I was like, that's strange, they don't normally drink after each other. And so then I noticed that it was fruit punch Gatorade, but it was clear. So then I looked at the one kid and I was like, does anyone need to step out of the class? No. Like, are you sure? No one needs to leave the class. No, ma'am. So I lock the door, call for the code. And as it's happening, I realize my students have alcohol in the class, and I'm gonna be bringing this to the forefront. And there's the policeman, the nurse, the principal, and the other security guard, and they have a breathalyzer. So they breathalyze the entire class. Now, am I concerned about my students' well-being, or I'm standing at the front of the room going, God, I hope they do not breathalyze me, because I know I'm gonna positively have a response to this. And they didn't breathalyze me, but 12 of my students did get popped that day and left class. So then, my cure was I needed geographic change. The problem is the school that I'm at, not me. So I changed to another school. Actually, I changed to the school that I went to in high school. And that summer, I started going back to AA. I started going to AA, I should say. My first meeting of my own free will was the Bayview group. And I met a woman in the room. Who most of us know, and she was my first sponsor in AA. And I could not put together 12 hours without drinking. I would go to meetings, I would hear things, I had notebooks with notes of important things that people said, and I could not figure it out. But that was my problem, was I thought that I could figure it out. I was smart enough to realize that my plans were not going as I wanted them to. But the drinking and the drugging was not the problem. The problem was all the PTSD I had, all the mental health. The problem was the boyfriend. The problem was anything but me. So that summer, going to AA and still lying about my usage, and I go to get my hair done on a Friday afternoon, and I'm drinking mimosas while I get my hair done. And I leave and I'm required to be at the football game. So I go to the football game with my Granby High School shirt, my last name, you know, stitched on the back of it. And it's raining and it's at Powhatan Field. And the last thing I know is I'm going down the stairs at the field, and I wake up in Virginia Beach Jail. I have no idea what occurred. I have to deconstruct the whole night. But I was taken by ambulance to Norfolk General, given a full workup, given pain medicine, given a prescription for pain medicine, and told that I was free to leave. I left and took a cab back to my car, drove to get the prescription filled, got a flat tire, someone changed it for me, drove to the ocean front from Ocean View, went on a date, because it's normal when you have a head injury to go on a date. And my date said that I was, you know, really drinking pretty hard and fast. And then from there, It's really fuzzy, but apparently he said I was talking to him on the through the car system. And I said, I'm getting pulled over, I'll call you back. And I was pulled over. I was given the whole breathalyzer thing. I blew a 0.15. So it was a DUI with a high BAC. Might not sound that high to you, but it's high enough to get automatically 5 days in jail. And so I was taken to Virginia Beach jail, called my parents who came and got me. The only thought I had was, I have a splitting headache. I know I have pills in my car. And I know when I get home, I'm going to have alcohol to follow that. My ex-boyfriend was my attorney. And I thought in my infinite wisdom that because of my head injury, I would be excused for my behavior. And the judge actually looked at me and the city, you know, it was my first time ever getting any ticket ever. I'd never had a speeding ticket. I'd never had any kind of violation. So I thought that would be in my favor as well. And I had all my medical stuff from the hospital. And the judge looked at me and said, if you try to argue this case in front of me, I'm going to give you 3 times across the board what you're going to get. You, as a teacher, should know we have to follow the law. It's not whether you intended to do it or not. It's whether you did it. And you did it. So I was like, okay, thank you. Going into Virginia Beach jail, I was calling women in the fellowship. And one woman was like, just pray. Just pray through the experience. So I get in there and I think, I'm going to help all these other women get their lives together. Mind you, I'm in the jail too, and my life is not together. Anyway, that next day after being arrested, I had to call my principal and tell him. So normally teachers would be fired for a DUI because I was considered a good teacher in a field that was of great need. I was given counseling, mandatory counseling. My counselor was like, you're one of the most severe alcoholics I've ever treated. And I was like, one of or the most severe? Because I like to be the best at whatever it is. I wish I could tell you that I stopped drinking then, right? The consequences are I'm losing jobs, I'm losing relationships, I'm losing things. Now I've got this criminal case in front of me. Every reason to stop drinking, but I continue to drink. That was in August. That semester, I kept getting really, really sick. I was, you know, in the hospital a lot. October rolled around, and it was a Friday morning, first block. Normally, my students would be asleep in that block. It was raining that day. Something about the rain in me always gets me in trouble when I'm drinking. So one girl comes up to my desk and says, Ms. McLean, we're worried about you. And I said, yeah, I've been sick lately. And they said, no, we're really worried about you and we want to pray for you. Now I told you I taught at Granby, it's not Norfolk Catholic or Norfolk Christian. So my students, while I'm sitting at the front of the room going, prayer in school, what are the rules? I don't know what to do. And they move all the desks. They get into a circle and they're holding each other. Two football players are on either side of me, holding me up. And she puts her hands on my head and prays over me. And I heard this voice that was not my own voice that said, if you are endangering these children, if they care more about you than you care about you, you are harming them. It was the only time I had ever thought that anything I was doing was dangerous to them. So I called for a substitute, and I called my dad. Now, my car was in the parking lot with the blow and go in it, but for some reason, I called my dad, and my mom is in the background yelling, is she getting arrested again? I went to my doctor, and again, I was honest about my drinking and my drugging. And he looked at me and said, I can take you out on medical leave, but it will be the end of your career. So he wrote a letter to the school board that said I was a danger to my students and myself, and I needed to immediately go on medical leave. I wish I could tell you that was the day that I quit drinking. I would suffer on for a couple more months. And I kept going to AA the whole time, right? I thought, maybe osmosis, I'll put the book next to my bed. I thought maybe I could read Drop the Rock. Someone in the meeting said it had really changed their lives. I thought, you know, if I got in the right sponsor line, if I got in the right this. I remember doing a fourth step with someone while I was still drinking. And I had like color coordinated it and all this stuff. And Elizabeth's way is always the more complicated way, but not the right way. In May, it was spring, I was on medical leave and I was going to a counselor and she looked at me and said, I think you're suicidal, you need to go to the psych center. And I was like, I have done this before, you know, they clean you up and spit you out and, you know, and I can do it for a couple of days, but there's really no point. And she's like, you don't have a choice, you have to go. So I went in and I met one of us in the hospital. He was a doctor there. And he looked at me and told me that I needed a spiritual solution. And I said, oh, I'm sorry, I thought you were the doctor. And he's like, I am the doctor, and I'm just like you. And he pushed the book of Alcoholics Anonymous across the table and said, I'm not going to prescribe a bunch of medicine. This is what you need. And I was like, yeah, I've tried that book. And he's like, no, you haven't. You haven't done the program. You've only done what you think you should be doing. I called another woman in the program, and I was like, I don't know what to do. I'm in the hospital again. And she said, why don't you pray for a different experience? And I was like, that's the dumbest thing anyone's ever told me. And she said, well, what do you have to lose? So I'll say that prayer for me and a religious answer or a spiritual answer or anything that involved the word God was immediately just very, very hard for me to take. Because I believe so much that I went to church as a child, but in my little five-year-old mind, you do good, you get good. You do bad, you get bad. So I had a lot of bad things happen to me. I must be a bad person, and God doesn't love me. So that is where my changing point will be in my story. In as I started to walk through sobriety, I have struggled with a higher power. I have the idea that my old fixed ideas will still come to the surface. So that last time in the psych center, someone else in the program gave me the suggestion of first thought wrong. Whatever your first thought is, do the opposite. So I started going to meetings every single day in a different city. I started going out to dinner with people, which was very painful in the beginning. Like, I'm so shy that I don't want to go and have to talk to you. Then I got a sponsor. I had to like chase her around meetings for almost a year to convince her that I was serious enough to do this. Because she's like, I don't have time for your little in and out stuff that you're doing. When you're serious about this program, I will sponsor you. So for a year, I had to convince her that I was serious. And so step one for me is definitely one of those things where even today, my life can still be very unmanageable when it's managed by me. I definitely started to realize that I was just full of crap, right? Like, as I go to meetings and I stop talking as a newcomer, because the only thing I knew was how to manipulate you and how to get what I wanted. So I would change up all my meetings. I got with this woman. We went through the 12 and 12 the first time. And I will say that it was a blessing for me, because I don't know that I was in the mindset that I could have handled the big book. So the 12 and 12 worked for me. We went through that. And then I kept being so afraid of my fourth step. But when I sat down and I actually wrote it, I loved talking about, well, and then in the third grade, Sally told me my hair was ugly, and I'm still holding on to that. But then getting to the fourth column of looking at my part of it was a little more difficult. I did a fifth step, six and seven. Some of my personality quirks, as I like to call it, or defects, I like to hold on to because I still can get something out of them. Eight and nine. I'm going to tell a story about Amy. Amy was an amazing mentor for me, and she has sponsored me in the past. But we had had a falling out for something that I had done, and I had avoided her for 3 years in the rooms, and then it was time to make an amends. So I'm sitting at the Easy Desert Club in my car, and I'm really early, and I'm Googling, how do you make an amends? What do you say in an amends? What's the proper way to make an amends, right? I really think that my academic mind is going to find the words to say to this woman on Google. And I went into meet her. And we spoke, and it was one of the most healing and beautiful experiences I had ever gone through. I could admit my faults. I could admit the way that I thought I harmed her, and she was beautiful through that experience. And we hugged and continued on our journey. But that's the thing is I keep thinking inside of me that I can do it. Like, I have the power to fix something. But really what I have learned through this experience is that the power comes from a higher power, right? And I have to connect with that higher power. So what sobriety looks like today for me, I'm still young in it, 7 years is relatively young. And I'm still willing to admit that I'm willing to work harder today than I did yesterday. I'm willing to say, I don't know. Like, I don't have the answers. That's the hardest thing for me to say. Someone will say, oh, well, do you know where such and such is in Suffolk? And I'll be like, yep, I do. I don't know anything about Suffolk, but I want people to think that I'm intelligent and smart, and so I lie a lot. But anyway, connecting with a higher power, I've learned that I don't do it gracefully. I'm quite obstinate and stubborn. I went through this thing last year where I changed sponsors, and I went with a really strict sponsor line that works really, really hard at the 12th step, and they're amazing, but you had to call at a specific minute. My call time was 5:30. If you called at 5:31, you got hung up on. So I was always really nervous about making sure I got my call on time. But then I would shut down and not, communicate what was going on with my sponsor. Because I keep thinking that something external is going to fix me, right? When I found that the solution in the big book is that it's that relationship with a higher power, I have to say that I got discouraged because even though my life has amazingly changed today, just simply by removing alcohol and removing drugs from my life, I still have the same brain. I still am an alcoholic to my core. I'm going to think alcoholically unless I do the steps. So today I have the privilege, I get to, people always say, well, are you a teacher? I still have my license. My license was not taken. But I am now taking care of my parents full time. My father has dementia as well as cancer and mesothelioma and heart condition. And he is, what a blessing it is that I get to be there for him today. He doesn't remember me 10 years ago. He doesn't remember all of the hell that I put that man through. At one point I stole all of his pain medication and I replaced it with Claritin. So he thought that he was taking it for the pain of cancer, and I had, of course, not told him. And at the end, when he found out, he said, if you had just asked me for it and told me that you needed it, I would have given it to you. Like, he loved me so much that he would suffer for me. Today, he's like, where do you go at night? And I, you know, I'll say I'm going to an AA meeting, and he's like, why, you don't drink? And I'm like, I don't drink anymore. But he doesn't remember that life before. And in a way, that's a blessing. I do sponsor other women. I think that my higher power has a specific sense of humor that's similar to mine, because a lot of the women that come into my life are different versions of me in different places. And I'll see something in them and I'll go, ooh, I've been there, I've done that, you know? And we get to walk that out together. I have changed sponsors again. And this has been a good experience for me. She's a teacher as well. So it's kind of like we have this symbiotic relationship of liking to tell people what to do, being full of it sometimes, but we do like to tell people what to do. Some of the challenges that I found is a lot of my resentments will become people in the program. I'm such a people pleaser that I will give and give and give, and then I'll secretly hold you responsible for my, you know, being tired or not wanting to do it anymore. So learning how to develop relationships based on spiritual principles has been a good thing for me. Sometimes I'm, you know, I've never left AA in the last 7 years, but I've definitely dropped down on my meetings. But back to that whole connection with a higher power. I think that when the meetings are smaller, we were talking about it being more vulnerable. Like, I think that I look up to people in AA and I definitely still admire what you have, right? Like, people that are quiet and content and living this life where they don't have a loud voice in their head telling them every day what a horrible person they are. I still fight that some days. And I don't have any desire to drink or drug. I mean, that was taken from me. But I will say that, like, it took me a lot of trial and tribulation and pain and anguish. But I did not surrender in the end. I believe that God surrendered me. And so today I do believe that God continues to look out for me and to guide me. You know, my parents are definitely getting older, single, without children. I have a really cute dog, though. I fear sometimes what will happen in the future, who will take care of me. And a good friend of mine and I were talking about this tonight and said, you know, that God will take care of me in the future. And that is directly a result of this fellowship. Definitely learning how to... I'm going through the steps again with this new sponsor, and looking at areas where growth is, you know, is needed. But the last year was probably my hardest year in recovery. Not only did I change sponsors 3 times, and home groups, which should have been a sign that something was wrong, when I think that you are the problem and not me, I went through a real period of depression over a guy. Because I'm still, you know, at the point where I think something outside of me can fix me. For a while it was this guy, and even though my friends who knew me really well were like, and my therapist was like, this is not going well, I continue to act like an addict, an alcoholic, right? This guy will fix me. I will be okay. And when that crashed and burned, I was left with me. So I committed to making sure that my meetings were up, that I was working with others, because I've learned that the solution for my depression is definitely to be of service to others. And so stepping up my game in AA has helped a lot. Let's see, I'm doing on time. I still have 5 minutes. What else has happened in recovery? One of the gifts that I've been able to bring into my world has been just learning how to say, like, I don't know. That's sometimes the hardest thing for me to say is, I don't know the answer. Let me get back to you on it. And other than that, life today, you know, when my sponsor suggested doing the secretary position, my first thought was, no, I don't want to do that. And my second thought was, what does the big book tell us? You know, what would my sponsor suggest? Well, my sponsor just suggested I do this. So I'm still very full of me. And every day I do get the daily reprieve of at least connecting and trying to bring it into a more healthy and balanced life. But other than that, I will say that I'm really grateful for this fellowship. I'm grateful for the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I learn every day how to be a little more connected to you. That's really what I'm seeking, is connection. And alcohol and drugs was the way of deadening that, so that I didn't have to feel anything. But I feel like I'm rambling now, so I'm going to stop. And thank you guys for listening.